Okay. So, Jim, you've pulled out an artifact here, a souvenir of your farming experience, the auction bill for the sale on the 25th of April, 03. And there's the machinery illustrated. Very good. There's the smaller four case tractor up there, I guess, is it? And
Yes.
then you had this earth-moving
Yes,
equipment
that's
here.
actually a little caterpillar scraper that I used for making grains on the farm.
So you had one of your own.
Yes.
And this gave you, did you use it? Not every year, I don't suppose.
In the beginning, yes, every fall I would be making grains, but towards the end I'd sort of work myself out of a job with it.
Yeah, I can imagine. But you kept it till you retired.
Yep.
Always available.
It went to Gretna, Manitoba.
Did it. And then here's
Those are
the
diskers
big
that I
disker.
seeded. I never did get into an air seeder. It
No.
ended for me
Right.
before.
So you kept on with the disker. And there, of course, is the big case tractor down here. At least I think I've got them. Yeah, that is
Yes.
the bigger one.
Yes.
And this is your spraying
Yes.
tank.
Yes. That was made by the Verstile Company here in Winnipeg. 800-gallon tank at 10 gallons per acre. I could spray 80 acres in approximately an hour and a half. It was a nice machine. And spraying, it's not so much time as timing. You've got to get out there at the right time. And if it's too windy or too cold or too hot or too late or too early, it's not good to spray.
No.
So that machine would go out and do the job quickly.
And you'd be pulling it with the
Yeah.
little case
Yeah.
tractor. You never used one of these sprayer in one unit on the big wheels and so
No,
on,
they
did you?
came in, they were coming in, but they were kind of coming in after me.
I see. And then we have a
That's a grain auger there.
here,
That's a
right.
Manitoba product.
Sure. The grain. There used to be elevators once upon a time, and then the augers
Yes,
came
then they went to
along
augers, and that
to
one
move the
there,
grain more efficiently.
it has a swing auger on it. You would just swing it out and back the truck up to that, and it transfers into the main auger.
Oh, yes, I see. And
That's a grain vacuum to empty bin bottoms. It's
oh, really?
basically a large vacuum cleaner like your household vacuum. And in that particular model, the auger carried it up into the truck. So the beauty of that was no dust when you were in the bin shoveling. There was no dust with that.
Now these are the steel circular bins we're talking
Yes.
about, which became so common. The old granary was gone,
Yes,
and grain was stored in.
every farm has big steel bins on
And
it now.
because
Yes.
of the conical bottom to it, it would largely drain by its without
Those
insulation.
we call hopper bottoms, yes. But for the flat bottoms,
Oh
you
yes, of
use
course.
these.
These are the ones that
Yes.
sit on the ground, and I'm thinking of
Yeah.
the ones up on
Hopper
steel
bottoms,
on the
yeah. Oh,
legs.
those are beautiful bins. You just pull the slide and out comes the grain.
I suppose they're fairly expensive, are they, compared to the arches?
Compared to the flat bottoms, yes.
Yeah.
And today they're building just like 10,000, 20,000 bushel bins as farms get bigger.
And then we have obviously
Yep.
the farm truck, the
Yeah.
grain box on it.
Yep, that's just a GMC truck.
Right. There's the cultivator.
Yes, that we talked about earlier.
Yes, and is that a harrow?
Yeah, that's a harrow bar.
So you would still be harrowing fields.
Yeah, behind the diskers you
Be
had to harrow, yes.
I see.
And I would harrow again in the fall, spread the straw in. There's a
And
Russian combine.
that's the Russian combine.
Yes.
Could have been Massey Ferguson, but that's good old Russian red,
Yeah.
eh? And
Made in Rostov
in Rostov on the
on the Black
Don.
Sea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is
That's
that?
a swather, self-propelled
Oh, the
swather is
swather. Yes, of course.
from the back. Eh? It was in the
Right.
shed.
Yes.
And that was made by CCIL in Winnipeg. And it has a Russian air-cooled motor in it.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Well,
And
well.
it was a good motor. I liked it.
Yeah.
Four-cylinder air-cooled.
Well, this is a splendid souvenir, and
Yes, it
you
is.
don't have any other copies of this auction bill, I don't suppose.
I don't know. The wife is the paper person here,
What
whether
we
we have any
it would be
left or
great
not.
to get a maybe a photo scan of this in color
Well,
for our collection, but thanks so much for pulling that out and
I'll
giving me
ask
a
her.
we'll talk about it later
Okay.
on.
I have one more here. I don't know if you want to talk about it now. This concerns my hobby.
I restored farm tractors as a hobby.
Did you now? I've got a cousin-in-law, if you will, in the Sanford area who's beginning to build his collection of John Deere tractors, and I see you've got four of them lined up there. Yes. So were these all your own equipment?
No. No, I bought them here and there and everywhere.
Yeah. But I mean, yes, they became yours.
Yes.
Right.
They were mine at the time of the sale. Yes,
I had restored them all. You sold them all off too.
What I had done is, in total, I had done 14. And what do you do with them after you're done? That's the sad part. So as I moved here, I didn't have a place to put them here. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? So I started adding up and putting it together, and just call Bill Kloss, and I have to let my babies go. So I did.
Well, let's focus for a few moments on the Oldsters down here. You've got two of them on steel.
Yeah, well, the case we talked about earlier, there it is. My dad had two of them.
Is that your dad's
yes,
tractor? It sat on the farm. Of course, there was no market for it when you went to rubber.
Oh, no, that wasn't his tractor, but he had two like it.
I see.
This one I picked up, and I'll tell you whose it was. It was old Bert Bass's tractor, your neighbor.
Okay. Well, well. And this other one?
This one I got from an uncle that lived at Lactobani.
And what?
That was the bigger model case. That was an L.
It's also
this
was a
C. Yeah.
I see. And then this is a... Could this be a Massey down here?
No, that's the back end of a John Deere Model D.
Oh, someone's...
It's unrestored.
That's rust, isn't it?
Yeah, that's rust. It's unrestored. That's an example of...
My father started with an old D, I think it was.
Model
would it have
D,
been
yeah.
D on steel and put it on rubber and whatnot and made other changes so that when he sold it in the early 50s to buy his first Fordson Major, which I think he was... Did he buy that in Fenna still? Or you may have bought it in Winnipeg, fellow who was taking it, was thinking about it for a trade, and I guess he took it, didn't believe it was a John Deere D because of the various things Dad had changed on it over the years. It was no longer stock by any means.
The D was the longest production run of any American tractor.
Was it? It was a splendid
piece of
equipment.
From 23 till 53.
30 years, eh?
And then the International Farmall Cub was very similar.
I see. And that's...
This is a little Alice Chalmers, you see.
Yes.
If I could buy them, I would buy them and restore them. Like, they were all rust buckets when I got them, and,
yeah,
you know.
Did this require welding things up and so on, or...?
Not very much welding. A lot of cleaning.
Obviously, you were referring to becoming a mechanic earlier, and obviously this requires a great deal of machine shop work. You had quite a machine shop on the farm, I suppose.
Yes, I did. I did. Some were absolute wrecks, and some like this one here, I virtually just painted it. But the fellow I got it from, his son had it into the vocational school in Steinbach and rebuilt the engine on it. Mm-hmm. So there was no need to do it again.
No. In other cases, you were opening the engines up and repairing them.
Yes, sometimes hammering the pistons out with a sledgehammer and oak piece of oak.
This is winter play, I take it.
Yes, it was winter play, yes. Something to do on the farm in the winter. You get good at it. When I did this one first, and when I had it all apart in the shop floor, I thought, I'll never get this thing back together again. But by spring, I did have it together, and it actually ran.
Be an enormous satisfaction to do the first one and
it
to realize that you could in fact do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I did auction them off, and they went, the furthest one, this one went to Ontario.
Did it.
And the others stayed, these two stayed right in my neighbor bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And the others stayed pretty local. One went to North Dakota. That was
now,
the furthest.
When they stayed local, this isn't it. That farmers were going to use them for their work. They were buying these as toys, in a sense.
Mostly it was the farmer said, I had one of these when I was growing up, and I want one now, as I sort of did.
Yeah. Well, if I were anywhere close to a farm, I suppose an old Model D and maybe one of those first Fords and Majors would be the sort of thing that I could certainly understand buying, restoring, and having as a lovely
reminder. You identify with them. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
That old case, I knew how to service it and everything just from watching them do it.
I see. Well, that's marvelous. Well, Chippa, I think we might move. We've done a good job of exploring various aspects of your farm life. I might ask what you'd like people to know about the work you did over the years as a farmer. What should people, city people, people who have never been on a farm, know about the work that you were doing?
It's unfortunate that we're not communicating with the city people, as most of the people in Canada today live in cities. And it seems like one generation just loses it completely. And we're not getting through to the young people what a farm is and where their food comes from. They think it comes from the stores.
Well, that's where they get it from, of course, but how did it get there?
And all they hear about farms is trouble. Farms are losing money, farmers are burning straw and smoking them out. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that we can't communicate better.
Yeah.
It was a great life. I wanted to farm, and I did. And I have no regrets. There was adversity, but when you like what you're doing, you will put up with the adversity.
I've heard farmers talk about being their own bosses.
Yes, you are your own boss, but you have to boss yourself.
Well, you've got to be a good manager, for sure.
Yeah, management is the big key,
yeah.
Definitely. You don't go golfing when it's time to thrash.
No, indeed.
You have to boss yourself. You have to say, I have to stay out here till 10 or 11 o'clock tonight. You don't go home early.
No. And you restore the tractor after the other machinery is in shape for the spring, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that was my winter project, restoring tractors. And I like doing it. If you don't like doing it, because it's 99% work and dirt, 1% show.
Sure.
But if you like doing it...
Yes.
The winter just flew by. It was a way I had of eliminating winter. Opened the door and doggone it, it's spring already. I'm not quite finished.
The Manitoba winters are worth getting over, all right. No doubt about it.
Well, I think they're getting milder. I might be wrong. Is it global warming? But three crops that they're now growing here are winter wheat, which wouldn't grow here before. Partly that was lack of drainage. It would flood out, freeze out in the spring. But soybeans, which are unheard of, and corn,
mm-hmm.
quite a bit of corn. Now, those are American Midwest crops, soybeans and corn. They're now growing them here successfully.
Yeah. And this is corn that they harvest. This isn't
yes,
being cut for silage.
Harvested corn, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
because one can always silage corn while it's still green.
Yes, no. There's that grown, too, by the dairymen. But this is... I know they're late this year because we had a cold, wet spring and corn is a heat-loving crop.
Well, I saw a field between Carmen and Winkler that was still standing there in late September and said to myself, what's going on here? But clearly part of that problem of the late
Yes, there's a quarter section just down here. As they're trying to grow it on this heavy Red River clay now,
mm-hmm.
there's this Allen Creek and Carmen is sandy soil so that they get more heat units there
mm-hmm.
and corn loves heat.
Oh, yes.
But the soybeans are being grown successfully here. They're satisfied with their yields. And, of course, the researchers are developing improved varieties
mm-hmm.
to bring the yields up. And edible beans will not grow in the Red River Valley because of the clay soil. The edible bean cannot take excessive moisture. The Winkler area grows a lot of edible beans because of the light loamy soil.
Right. Clearly for farmers as a group or for over a region, soil quality and soil differences are very significant determinants of what one can do on a farm, aren't they?
Oh, they sure are. They sure are. Soils are extremely variable and very different as to what crops they'll grow. And
you said something earlier about soil quality, whether it would be might be necessary to go back to rotation, did you actually suggest, as the soils... soil becomes
Well, as we lose organic matter, it's the university professors and that talk about organic matter. And I once asked one, I said, how much organic matter have we lost since we broke up this soil? And he said, about half. So we got half to go. Now, if we can't get organic matter back into the soil, it becomes hard and lifeless and water won't transpire through it. So by plowing down green crops like sweet clover, you're putting organic matter and lightening the soil up again.
Yes.
When you use chemical fertilizers, you aren't. But returning the straw is another method of, rather than burning it off, is another method of returning organic matter. Like sure. It took like 10,000 years to build up the organic
yes.
matter in our soil.
And we've got rid of half of it in a century or so.
And yes, you see, we're still new here. We're still new as farming goes. It happened in the U.S. Southeast with their continuous cotton crops and mm-hmm. the soil.
Terrible erosion resulted and all the rest of it.
Yes.
Yes, they sometimes talk about soil mining rather than farming in some
We talk about it too. And the farmer is forced to mine the soil because of economics. The almighty dollar speaks the loudest. And the farmer would prefer a better practice, but because of economics, he's got to take the most economical route
yes.
to produce a crop.
Of course, crop wheat prices, for example, have been very low for so much of your farming experience, too, I expect.
Yes.
The high prices of the early 70s were a
short-lived.
Very brief experience of paradise, which turned out not to be, as you were saying, with the
yes.
Elm Creek Co-op. It could have its problems.
Yes.
Difficult.
There's a problem looming right now, and the prices in 07 shot up very high. The machinery companies are back-ordered on new combines and tractors, and prices are down already. But those tractors and combines are coming.
How does a farmer commit himself to a purchase of a combine? What does he do? Sign a contract, a bill of sale,
and put money down?
And
you're talking $300,000,
$350,000. I know. I'm talking about a bank involvement, I expect.
You've got to sign a contract with the company that you're buying that machine and probably put money down. Then they'll build it. They don't have a stockpile anymore.
Is that what's happening with combines? They're being built to order?
Pretty much, yes.
The farmers.
Like the major companies are sold out of equipment, tractors and combines.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just too much inventory sitting around if it's unsold.
Yes.
It comes to millions of dollars.
Yes.
So they're...
What kinds of government programs have been important to you over the years in surviving as a farmer, right? If that's not pressing the point too far.
I received subsidies when prices were low, and I didn't like government subsidies. I would have rather have gotten a good price for my grain and not bothered with the bureaucracy of getting your subsidies. But you had to at times. Now, one important program is crop insurance. I farmed with it for 40 years. And in the end, they sent me a statement of my account, and I think I owed them $2,000 or something. They had paid me, and I had paid premiums, and in the end, I owed them $2,000. I came out $2,000 ahead.
So do they ask you to pay that in?
No. They just sent me a statement. But what it was security.
Okay.
I never got a lot of money from crop insurance, but the times when if a crop would fail or something, they
mm-hmm.
did pay out,
mm-hmm.
and that
mm-hmm.
Was security.
So this is a reminder to the farmer to be grateful at the end of his career then when they tell him how he fared.
It's a good government program. Government programs are out there. Sometimes they miss the mark.
That one's provincial, isn't it, the crop insurance?
Yes, but it's federally funded too. Federal picks up a share of it.
I see.
And it's provincial.
And then the operations of the wheat board, of course, over the years.
I'm a wheat board supporter. You probably hear a lot about the wheat board, and even our present government is not pro wheat board, but I am. It served me well over the years. The wheat board will not get you high prices when prices are low, but it'll get you the best price it can. Mm-hmm. And it's a pooled price so that you can deliver your grain at any time and get paid.
Yes.
If there's a profit to be had, it'll be returned to you when the wheat board.
The wheat board, with its establishment for good, there was an earlier one in the Great War, in 1935 or so.
Yes.
I suppose served for the whole industry what pools in the various provinces had been aspiring to do from the 1920s onwards, and maybe the UGG before that, in which they tried to persuade all the farmers to pool their product together so that a central agency would then sell it. The wheat board took over that function and was given the force of law to boot.
Yes.
And so the grain companies that were operating were really providing services within that, weren't they, in terms of receiving the grain, and the railway shipped it, and then in Thunder Bay or other ports, there were the grain companies, again, very largely the pools and others with the terminal elevators and so on and so forth. Have you seen changes in that system in these last years or not? When Cargill came in, for example, and they built that big throughput elevator at Elm Creek, as is one of the first on the prairies, I think, as a matter of fact, isn't it?
Yes, it may have been. I don't think it was as big a change as Cargill hoped for. The pools and United Grain Growers continued to handle a lot of grain. In fact, the pool elevator in Elm Creek handled a lot more grain because some people weren't satisfied with what Cargill was going to give them. They just went over to the pool and dumped the grain there. So
Cargill actually built up pool business in Elm Creek.
Yes, it did. But I guess the system had to change, and the companies all went to these big concrete elevators.
Yeah.
And I say they went too far too fast.
Why would you say that?
Well, the pools got themselves deep in debt by doing it. And I don't think that it was necessary to sell off the pools as was done. I think that debt could have been managed and paid off.
The Viterra development, ultimately.
Yes. Yes, and they swallowed up United Grain Growers, and the farmers lost their cooperative grain system.
Did the going to the to Bay Street, selling stock, was that a matter of trying to acquire capital to offset the debts that had been run up? Is that what actually happened? Saskatchewan Wheat Pool in particular did that. Manitoba Pool may not have. Do you have a sense of that or not?
Run that by me again.
The Saskatchewan Wheat Pool sold stock in Toronto on the stock exchange, became a publicly traded company rather than being, you know, a farmer's mutual or whatever you'd want to call it. Do you have any sense of why they did that? Or is that just something that sort of happened elsewhere?
Why they did it?
Because you don't have an answer. Don't worry about that. I'm just wondering.
I don't think no. I can answer that.
No. As you were mentioning, the debts run up and so on and so forth.
Yes. Well, they were borrowing money. Where they were getting it from, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like Manitoba Pool, the debt was manageable and it could have been paid off and remained a cooperative system. I myself hope that the three prairie pools and United Grain Growers would have amalgamated into one super co-op and be in the hands of the farmers.
Yes, instead of becoming what is now a publicly traded company, I guess, but it's certainly not in the farmers' control any longer.
It's you can buy shares in Viterra or Richardson or whoever you want.
Yes.
But it's not a farmer-controlled cooperative anymore.
Do the farmers feel the issue keenly? You've indicated your own support for the wheat board with its long-standing policy, place in law.
So if you want to debate, just go to the coffee shop.
The farmers will...
The wheat board's not mentioned in the coffee shop because it'll flare up pretty quick. There's pro-wheat board and anti-wheat board, and the debate will be on hotly.
You want to characterize both sides briefly? why you're pro wheat board. You may have already have said that in a sense, but why are others?
Why I'm pro wheat board is because the wheat board gets you the fairest price possible. The private grain trade works for the greatest profit possible. So how do they get the profit? If they can buy the grain at the lowest price possible, mm-hmm. there's a profit margin there. Mm-hmm. So who are they working for? Whereas the wheat board, and some farmers just will not or do not understand that the wheat board is not competing with the grain companies. It is merely a selling agency. They are selling the grain, deducting the costs of marketing this grain and returning the money to the farmer. And they sell for the world price, which is set on the Chicago Board of Trade.
Yeah.
That's where they draw their price from.
Sure.
So they can't get you a high price when prices are low. They get you a fair price,
right.
A fair pooled price. And it's a pooled price. If you sell high and wheat goes way up, you'll get a return of that. It's a pooled price.
Sure.
So I support the wheat board. Many farmers don't. And there has been a fair amount of anti-wheat board propaganda going around by non-farm interests that the wheat board is part of your problem. And if we would get rid of this wheat board, you'll be in a more profitable position.
When private grain companies make that case, their self-interest is obvious and the farmers should recognize it.
Yes.
They're planning to make money. Someone's going to lose.
Yes, they should. And if the wheat board is so bad, well, just leave it there in the corner and nobody will deal with it.
No, go ahead.
But it's not happening.
No, farmers are still eager to deal with it. Well, Jim, I'm glancing over questions here. We still have some time left, but would a question such as what might interest or surprise people most about the work you did, would that bring any thoughts to mind, or is that a question not worth... Or what are you most proud of in the work you did over the years? Maybe that you survived as a farmer first.
There's a great deal of pride in the farm community. Farmers are always portrayed as being not too smart and kind of dirty overall, but they're not that at all. There's a lot of pride in farmers, in what they own. They own their farms. They're very proud of that, although that is slipping away from us now, too. It was a great place to live, great place to raise kids, and I'd certainly do it again.
Did you have a sense of continuing a family tradition in being a farmer? This is something that your ancestors had done from time immemorial, one might say, in Europe. And
I guess it wasn't too deeply ingrained in me. I always thought that I had a son, and yes, he'll take over the farm. But I always thought that if he didn't want to farm, that would be his option. Mm-hmm. I would not try to force him to carry on the family tradition.
No. But it was a tradition you were conscious of yourself, that you were doing something that your father, grandfather, and ancestors had done.
In the past, we were much more farm-oriented. Farming is very specialized today. In the past, you farmed every day, year-round. And today, it's very seasonal. Mm-hmm. There's the spring seeding season. Shortly after that, there's the spraying season, where you go, go, go. And then there's the harvest season.
And with haying gone, what came in between into July was the haying season once upon a time, but that's largely gone. So
yes,
it ends up being just those...
The spraying season.
Yeah, well, I guess you're right. Spraying wasn't big in those days. So it can be combined with other activities, of course. And did you know many farmers who had paid work and farmed on the side, or was that not common in your experience?
There is, particularly around Winnipeg. There's farmers that have retained maybe just their small farm mm-hmm. from their father and work in Winnipeg.
A small farm here could be 240 acres, I suppose, or something like that, could it?
Yes, there's many of those around Winnipeg, especially on the east side. They work in the rail shops. They work for versatile manufacturing. and retained their small farms. And as you go west, I think you'd find less of that in Saskatchewan. They're big.
Yeah, farms grow.
Even in this...
Thousands of acres.
Yes, west side of the Red River Valley, most farms are big. Some farmers work out too, or to start with. I once counted in the northwest area of Fannistel 30 farms that were there. Today there's only 3 that live in that area. Others come into farm, but there is only 3 farmsteads in that area where there was once 30.
That's reduction.
So you can see...
increase in size of farms.
Yes. And you can trace that back to every generation of tractor. Every generation that came out had more horsepower, so it could farm more land. First, when I started, took over from my father, the 240 farm was disappearing fast. And at that time, the average prairie farm was 240 acres, and I was farming 800. When I finished farming, the average prairie farm was 800 acres. And you would really need 24 to be viable.
Those are incredible changes.
Yes, and big tractors are responsible. And here in this Red River Valley, with the big square miles, the big tractor works well.
You just work the whole length of the either way.
There's many full section fields today. Full section, half section.
Right.
Yeah.
As against which, in my own memory of a farm yard in the corner with a pasture attached.
Yes.
And then the field around that was the first... that was the first 80 acres. Then there were 2 80-acre fields after that. And those would have to be divided up appropriately to get in the two crops in the summer follow.
Yes.
And why to think of a field that is a whole square mile in size, with the next one probably being another square mile.
Yes, there's many square mile fields today.
Yes. Yeah, incredible changes. You suggest the tractor is making it possible, more powerful tractors. I suppose it was the price of the product, wheat prices particularly, that were another factor in that. Did farmers feel they needed to grow more in order to realize the income? Or do you have any thoughts about the way in which sort of the cost of production related to the price of the product and what the economics of the farm?
Yes, your return per acre is lower, so you counter that with more acres to pay for that big tractor to get over these acres.
But that's to pay for the tractor. Now, did you need the...
Well, all your expenses, we'll say.
Yeah, or all the expenses.
Yes, because your return per acre is lower, so you need more acres. You got more acres, you get a bigger return.
So the tractor, despite its great cost, leaving the combine aside now, is more efficient, is cheaper per acre of work it does, actually?
Oh, definitely, yes. Tractors of today are much more efficient. They do much more work than their predecessors, and faster. Mm-hmm. So you swallow your neighbor to...
Yeah. Hopefully at the right age to retire.
See, when you buy this big equipment, you have to have an economy of scale. You have to have the acres to make it productive.
Yeah.
Because if it's sitting in the yard, it's not producing for you.
No. And of course, that's one of the haunting things with that combine. It sits there most of the year to serve for a week or 10 days.
Yes.
And yet it isn't easy to pool the work. Farmers couldn't share in a combine because the harvest season is short, I suppose. And you've got to have your...
That's right. That's right. Particularly in Canada, the harvest season is pretty short. You'll see a lot more custom harvesting in the United States, say Kansas or Nebraska, where it's hot and dry for 3 months.
Yes.
But here, we got basically just enough weather to get the crop off in good condition. And if you don't get it off in good condition, you take a big discount in your grades.
Yeah. Did you know anyone who did this custom combining would take a machine perhaps as far south as Texas and then harvest his way north for months on end till he got up to Canada as the wheat ripened? You knew someone who did that?
Yes, there was a few that did it from here. That's an interesting story. You know, the advent of the custom combiner and the Massey Harris company at that time. You see, in the Second World War, with the manpower being swept away, they needed a more efficient way of getting the crop off. And Massey Harris had been experimenting with a self-propelled combine. So the Canadian and American governments gave them the go-ahead to develop this combine, whereas the other companies went into war production. So at the end of the war, Massey came out with a good, viable, self-propelled combine, and they would form these big harvest brigades to harvest the crop, because there had been a lack of equipment produced during the war. And that was the 21A combine. It became the 27 combine, and they harvested the crop with that. Gas motor, red hot manifold, 4 miles an hour, top speed.
My father bought what he understood was the first self-propelled combine in the Elm Creek District. Someone had bought it, I think, in the late 30s. This would have been one of the pioneer
combines. That would have been a 21. There wasn't many 21s around.
That was galvanized steel outside. And I think a farmer named Ivy, I think, had owned it.
Ivy, yes, I recall the Ivy's.
And Dad bought that combine after the war and into the 50s, I think, and he combined with that for years.
The galvanized sides is the dead giveaway. That was the 21 Massey. That was the first one out, which soon evolved into the 21A, which was painted red.
And this was the one after the war, developed through the war.
Yeah, yeah.
That is quite a story.
Yeah, it is.
And these Massey-Harris combines then were, I suppose, the state of the art, as we say, in the
oh God, yes.
Academic community.
And they were so far ahead in developing a self-propelled combine that it took the other companies 20 years to catch up to them.
That's quite a story.
Well, that's the story of grain harvesting from Egyptian times on is interesting.
It is indeed, and just over 100 years in Western Canada, from the old binder drawn by horses and the threshing machine and so on and so forth, through to these self-propelled combines and
the change
and the sophisticated combines that developed. Yes, yes. It really is quite a story. Well, we've talked about all kinds of changes, challenges, I suppose, other challenges. One was just of surviving in the business, of course, but were there other challenges that you faced as a farmer?
No.
Or that the industry faced, perhaps, if more than yourself? I suppose one of them would be surviving lean times and yes, good times.
Yes,
dealing with the cycle of the grain.
Making the farm successful was management. I kept a graph all the years that I farmed, income and expense, a line graph. If income would drop, expenses would drop with it.
You would have
to. I always kept that blue line above the red line for 40 years. Sometimes it was close. Sometimes they'd both drop drastically. So obviously I was quick on the cutbacks when grain prices would fall.
Sure. Did you take any farm management courses?
Just one. I did take one. It was sponsored by the government at a time of very low grain prices in wintertime, and it was a good course. I learned from it. And I think the agricultural diploma course is very good. Mm-hmm. What you learn there, and sometimes it's bad, sometimes you learn too much, but you will learn it in the field. You're what I call a field-trained general. He's a hard guy to beat. But when you go to take 2 years of agricultural diploma course, they run by it all for you there. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to get out and put it together, as any university course is. You've mm-hmm. got to take hold of it and make it work.
Sure.
But I think it's a good thing to have, and most farmers today do take it.
And bright farmers, of course, can... Or bright professors trying to be farmers can lose their shirts too, I understand.
Yes, we had that experience in Fannistel too.
You want to tell me what you understand of that particular operation? I remember driving out to visit my neighbors in the McIntyres once, and I, along Highway 2, and there was this great spread of bins and granaries and whatnot and augers and all the rest of it. And I got to them, and I said, oh, incidentally, there's this big operation on the south side of Highway 2 near Fannistel. Whose is that? And they said, oh, that's Professor So-and-so. Forgotten his name from the University of Manitoba. He's gone bankrupt there. Okay, you want to let that go.
Kill it.
Kill it. Just slide the record lever. If I were to ask you what some of your most vivid memories of being a farmer are, what could you tell me?
One would be the what I call the mud years, when we had extremely wet harvests. And it became very difficult to harvest the crop. And they seemed to occur at the same time as low grain prices. So there you were, fighting the mud and piling up this damp grain, which is out of condition and not going to keep very long, and getting a low price for it, and having to dry it at the same time. Mud always wins. You don't win against mud. We tried everything. Farmers would buy track combines, try to put tracks on their swathers to float on the mud, and at great cost, and it wasn't too effective. So the mud years are a vivid memory, and I had three of them, 1968, 1985, and 1993. I have no trouble naming them all.
That's something. So 68 was one of those years, and my father sold the firm in 69.
Is
so
that I right? Guess he went through the mud. I know what he went through. Prices were low. Sales to Russia collapsed in 97, which was produced a beautiful crop. Prices tumbled down. There was no sale for wheat. And
you said 97?
Oh, I'm sorry. 67. In 1968, prices were very low. I had mounds of this damp grain in the yard. What to do with it? I ended up drying quite a bit on the farm.
You could buy grain dryers, machinery.
Yeah, dryers were available. They were propane heated and dried the grain.
So that's an expense.
It's an expense, and it's difficult to remove moisture from grain. It is difficult. It's a slow process. You would spend 2 to 3 hours, depending on the amount of moisture in the grain, get it out.
What the sun does at no expense to us is difficult to duplicate. Eh?
It's expensive. You're burning propane big time. That's a big burner, and a diesel tractor running all day long. And then we'd bin it because there was no sale for it. So that stands out in your memory.
I'm sure. And then you said 85 and 93 were similar years.
And 68, yeah, the
3 years. 68, 85. And
yes, mud years.
Yeah. Only three over 40 years.
Yes.
Not too bad in the way of odds, I suppose.
79 was a bit wet, but the price of grain was high, and I would go out and I would thrash some mud holes and take a 3-ton truck to the elevator and get $1,000 for it. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so bad. You'd go home and clean the mud out of the wheels. But yeah, three out of all those years wasn't so bad in looking back.
Were you ever hail damaged?
Yes, twice. Never completely, but hail damaged twice.
Hail damaged.
Yes.
So that as far as the real vagaries of the weather, of course, there were the dry years as well, I suppose. How many of those?
There wasn't many dry years.
It's the Assiniboine River Valley. Eh? There's moisture there as well.
I'm thinking 1980 was. 1980 was severe south of number 2 highway, and I had half a crop. And I think 1988 was a dry year. Mm-hmm. But half a crop again. Mm-hmm. The difference with the dry year is I always said if I have to lose a crop, I'd rather lose it to dry than wet, because you go out there and you clean it up quickly and it's usually number one grade and it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But wet, you fight with it for 2 months or more.
Yes.
Trying to get it off, and it's usually low quality.
My father maintained a good relationship with the manager of the Bank of Commerce in Elm Creek. Is a bank important to farmers? Was your experience and the experience of other farmers in terms of financing the operation?
Yes, it is. The banks and credit unions, a lot of farmers deal with credit unions, which is a banking cooperative, mm-hmm. is what it
yes,
is.
Yes, of course.
They obtain operating loans. Mm-hmm. And largely, I think, equipment loans are done through the companies themselves. They have their own finance companies. And but the banks provide a service in borrowing money to farmers.
Has the sort of national and sometimes international business cycle in its financial ramifications affected you much over the years? Let's say, of course, the terrific inflation of the early... You're a commodity producer, so I guess 72, 73, 74, those were boom years. The early 80s, though, interest rates were drawn up so high by the Federal Reserve in the United States, Paul Volcker's attempt to bring the dollar under control. Did those high interest rates impact the farmers particularly?
Oh, yes, greatly. Fortunately, I had a mortgage with the Farm Credit Corporation, and at that time, interest was still pegged. But shortly after, interest floated. And anybody that got caught in the high interest rates, sure, that impacted them, that hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate to have a 25-year mortgage that pegged interest. That financing is...
In the early 90s, again, when John Crow was trying to end inflation in the country, and this on top of the goods and services tax and NAFTA or the FTA, did you experience impacts from that on the farm particularly?
Yes. Interest rates, of course, affect farming very much, and their suppliers. And the grain companies mm-hmm. are all affected by
the low interest rates running in the very last years that you farmed, I suppose, were a pleasant contrast.
Yes, and at that time, well, I wasn't borrowing money. I was done. I was sort of successful. I was done with paying interest, and but they were lower. And
did you have a sense that it was a good time to sell when you got out of farming around 2003? There were people ready to buy the farm, take it over, and there were people ready to come to your auction sale and get good prices.
Yes, the auction sale brought good prices. We didn't sell the farm; we still rent it.
Oh, I see.
It would sell at good prices right now. Yes. Mm-hmm. Farmland is in demand. But the decision to sell was, I was 62 years old. Most of my equipment was getting on 20 years old. And at that age, you're not going to buy a new big tractor and take on more land. It's
a lot of life cycle, your life and equipment life and so on that goes into these decisions.
Yes. So it was time to get out.
And of course, you want to get out in a way that allows you to enjoy your retirement, because the farm has been largely the basis for your farm income.
Yes. Well, I think we farmed successfully. We own the farm. We own this house. You know, we did okay that
way. I think that's success.
Didn't
looking
get
around,
rich.
Looking around, that's success. Do farmers have money in the CPP, the Canada Pension Plan? As a rule?
Yeah, we paid into it,
You paid into it, so you get that, and the old security is available to you as well.
Yes.
EI has never, of course, that'd be for employees anyway, so you were never part of unemployment insurance.
We paid the whole thing. Your employer pays half, and you pay half as an employee.
Did you employ workers over the years?
Nope. The wife was the employee.
I see. yes, of course, when she was... providing important functions on the farm, of course.
Way back in 75, we decided we'd buy a microwave oven and a dishwasher, and that would free her up in the kitchen. And
sure.
Like, she'd drive tractors, combines, trucks, everything.
Oh, I see. Yes. So she was fully a partner working the farm.
Yes, so we didn't hire hire anybody. She helped out in the busy seasons, you know, through the... And then...
Well, a concluding question. We've actually got just over a minute left. Are there any questions that remain that I might have asked? Any thought, anything that we could have dealt with? Or have we covered the waterfront, as they say, in another industry?
I think we did a pretty good job.
We've been over all the acreage?
I think so.
Well, splendid. Yeah. It's been a great pleasure to sit down and to learn about your life after these many years of only seeing you once between almost 57 and
yes,
and 97 maybe. Was that the centennial, 98, whatever it was in Kelross, when you were driving the tractor and on down the street in Kelross? It was about 10 years ago.
Yes.
And here we are again. Well, it's splendid. Thanks very much on behalf of the Voices of the Grain Trade Project for giving me the chance to come in and talk to you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the interview.
It's great to have done it. So I guess I can push stop, Ken.